Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Talmud Le'at. And we will start, as we always do, with review. So I know some of you were not here last week, so I'll try to make this a little more comprehensive. So last week we started chapter 3, Perek Gimel, which is Hamaniach. So as I explained, every chapter is known by the first few words in the chapter. Chapter 1 was Arba'a Avot, the four primary categories of damagers. Chapter 2 was Ketzad HaRegel, how the foot, which is talking about damage done by the foot of an animal. And this is Hamaniach, one who places, and one who places what. So we started, of course, with a new Mishnah, and the Mishnah had two pieces to it. The first was the pitcher in the public domain. So a person does not have the right to leave objects in the public domain. So if somebody comes along and breaks it, that person is exempt. And the second part of the Mishnah was injury from the broken pitcher. So if the broken object, the broken vessel, injures that person, then the owner of the object is liable for damages. So that's the Mishnah, and we'll be coming, well, to a related Mishnah. Then the Talmud had a segue on the difference of pitcher versus jugs, because the Mishnah started with the Hebrew word for pitcher, kad, and it ended with the Hebrew word for jug, which is chavit, and the Talmud spent a while on, is that meaningful, or is it just a vocabulary thing? And it's kind of both. So the whole question now about breaking things in the public domain is the question of, aren't people obligated to watch where they walk? You would think if you see a pitcher and you can walk around it, then if you break it, it's kind of intentional on your part. So we had three Amoraim try to qualify that. And there must be some kind of extra circumstance that would make this true. And we had three heavy hitters. So Rav said, they're really talking about is there are too many jugs and you can't walk around them. Shmuel said, it's talking about a case where it's too dark to see anything and that's why you break into the pitcher. And Rabbi Yochanan said, no, it's the jug is around the corner. So you turn around the corner and you can't see it. But all of this really means that people should watch where they're going. All these circumstances are kind of exceptions to that. So there does seem to be an understanding that people are obligated to watch the road. Then we got into a very interesting topic of taking the law into one's own hands. And it is limited. It's restricted. It's not like we allow vigilantism in the Talmud. It's a case, there have to be two limitations here. One is that the dispute is restricted to a monetary case. And the second is it's restricted to a case where you can take the law into your own hands. And if you don't, you will suffer a loss by waiting to go to court. And the initial example was two people have an agreement that they use a well on alternate days. And person one goes on his day and finds person two drawing water. So person one beats up person two and takes the water. And they decided that was okay because person one would suffer a loss, the loss of the water for that day. Now, of course, this was disputed. And Rabbi Yehuda said, no, you're not allowed to do this. And this launched the Talmud into its usual mode of presenting hypothetical cases to support Rabbi Yehuda. And we saw three cases. Well, I don't have it here. One was the bizarre case of where you have one ox on top of another and the owner removes the bottom ox, the top ox falls down and hurts itself. The second case was if you're living in a house and there's your courtyard and your neighbor fills it up with jugs, you get to break the jugs to get out or into your house. And the third case was a little more technical. It was about a freed slave, a slave that goes free on the Jubilee year, and he doesn't want to go free. And the Torah says, if that's the case, you take the slave and you put him against the doorpost of your house and you bore a hole in his ear. And in doing so, you injure the slave. So are you now obligated to pay for the injury to the slave? That was last week. Now, where we start tonight is actually we're going to pick up where we left off. So there were three attempts on these hypothetical cases to show that a person does not have the right to take their law into their own hands. These three were rejected. And now we are going to have an additional four more cases trying to make this. And with that, they all start with Tashma, come and hear. And that means basically we're going to pitch a hypothesis, which I think is always proven wrong. So here we go. Come and hear. One who places a pitcher in the public domain and another one comes and stumbles over it and breaks it, he is exempt. The reason is that he stumbled over it, but if he breaks it, he is liable. So the Mishnah is talking about a situation where one person leaves his stuff in the public domain, which he doesn't have permission to do. The person walking there, however, cannot break them intentionally. He is exempt only if he stumbles, and that's why there's an emphasis on the word stumble, nitkal, and it kind of proves the opposite then, that one may not take the law into his own hands in this case. Rabbi Zvid said in the name of Rabba. Rabbi Zvid is a fifth generation Babylonian Amora, and he was a very devoted colleague of Abaye, so much so that it is rumored that he was poisoned because he had strong insistence that you had to follow Abaye's ruling. So think about that when you think about rabbis. So Rav Zvid comes along and says, this is the law even if he broke it. And this teaches he stumbles, nitkal, because it wanted to teach the last clause. And if you remember, we had a resha and a seifa, the first clause and the last clause. If the owner of the pitcher was injured by it, he's liable for the damage, as specifically if he stumbles. But if he breaks it, no, since he damaged himself, the first clause teaches he stumbles. So Rav Zvid is saying this is not a proof, since you may break them even intentionally because you can take the law into your own hands. The Mishnah says stumbles only because the second clause is true, only if he stumbles. So if a person is walking in the public domain intentionally and he breaks something else, he cannot claim any damages. He hurt himself. That's why the Resha explicitly teaches stumbling. So the proof is rejected. Question.
So, yeah, I'm a little lost because I'm having trouble following all the pronouns. Which he is he?
Yeah. He is the owner of the pitcher or the jug.
Is not the owner of the jug is not liable for damages if the person stumbles and falls.
No, he is. He is if he stumbles. But he's saying if he does it intentionally, no.
If the person
who breaks it is not responsible.
If the person walking by broke the pitcher, then that person is responsible for breaking the pitcher.
Well, Rav Zvid said he doesn't have to pay for it.
He's responsible for breaking it, but he doesn't have to pay for it because it didn't belong there in the first place.
Yes.
But if he stumbles over it, that's a different issue.
Right.
Then the person who placed the pitcher there is liable.
Yes. Okay. Because it's a hazard.
Okay.
And the Talmud is using the word break to connote intent.
No, it's break is break.
So you could break it by accident too?
Sure. You turn, you don't see where you're going and you break it.
Isn't that stumbling?
Yeah, so I'm having trouble understanding the difference between stumble and break in the text.
because there's really stumble and break, and there's really intentional and non-intentional. So I guess stumbles means non-intentional, but break does not mean intentional. You can break it intentionally or unintentionally. So I'll admit that it's confusing. Rosvid says you could break it intentionally or unintentionally. That's where the difference comes. But if you have the opposite point of view, which would be Rav Yehuda, then there would be a difference. So Rav Zvid said there isn't. And I'll move along before I get confused myself. All right, so that case is rejected. So now we have case number five, Tashma, come in here. Then you shall cut off her hand. So I didn't put the proof text in for this, but this is a verse in the Torah that says, if a man is fighting with another man and the wife of the first man reaches in and grabs the attacker's genitals, then you shall cut off her hand. That's what the Torah is saying.
Yeah.
So the dash monetary restitution is the rabbi saying, this is a fine, not a literal cutting off of the hand. What? Is it not where she cannot save by other means? No, where she can save by other means. So the rabbi is saying if there was no other way to save her husband, then this rule seems to prove that one may not take the law into one's own hands. But the Talmud rejects this because the woman is fined only if she could have saved her husband in some other way. All right, this is already confusing, but now it's going to be worse. But if she was not able to save him by other means, she is exempt. That's a question. If so, instead of teaching the last clause, again, she puts forth her hand to exclude an officer of the court, let it distinguish and teach within itself. To what does this refer? When she can save him by other means. But if she cannot save him by other means, she is exempt. So the Talmud is raising a difficulty here. In short, if she is exempt when she can't save him by other means, then the Baraita should have said that explicitly. So why do we understand the phrase she extends her hands? It really means that she is doing it and not an officer of the court. Because an officer of the court who intervenes would be exempt. Think of it as a police officer. Police officer is allowed to break up the fight even if he or she would damage the attacker. So the fact that it exempts the court officer implies that the citizen would not be exempt normally, even if there was no other way to save the person. But wait, there's more. This is also what it is saying. To what does this refer? And I got to tell you, it all sounds alike. Where she can save him by other means, but if she cannot save him by other means, her hand becomes like the officer of the court and she is exempt. So the Talmud here is affirming that if she cannot save him by other means, she is indeed exempt because she is like an agent of the court. And all of this seems to be obvious, right? A person can defend someone who is being attacked.
But isn't that contrary to what the last one just said?
Correct. And that's why it's rejecting the last one.
Oh, okay.
See, the only reason to punish her would, or anyone who tries to stop a fight, would be if the action is unnecessary or gratuitous and the fight could be stopped by other means. So basically she's saying whether she had other means or she didn't have other means, she's exempt. Meaning, again, she can't take the law into her own hands, and that is the proof of it. Now we come up with a little more interesting and easier to understand example. So this is proof number six, Tashma, come in here. Here's the scenario. A person owns a field, and the field has a public road passing through it. So the owner of the field appropriates the public road in the middle of his field, and he gives on the side of the field a new public road. That's the scenario. What does the Brayta rule? What he gave is given, and his has not reached him. So what he gave has given means he gave away the new public road. He lost. That's done. His has not reached him is Talmud terms, meaning he still has no longer has control over the road in the middle of his field. So he gave it away. Everyone get that? So the Brayta rules in the sack, the road he gave to the public now belongs to the public, but he cannot take his old road back. It has not reached him. And if you say that one may take the law into one's own hands, let him take a stick and sit, which is a very good phrase. So in a discussion elsewhere, the Talmud really does believe he has the right to take the old road back, but he would have to go to court to get it back. So the fact that he can, now what does sit, stick and sit mean? It means he could sit on the road he gave away, the old road, with a stick and attack anyone that tries to go on the road. That's what this is saying, which is the basic line here of you're allowed to take the law into your own hands. But the fact that he cannot sit there and physically prevent people from going on to his property proves that he can't take the law into his own hands. And you'll say, why not? It seems to say he can. So now we have three rabbis that give answers to this. Rav Zvid, we just had, says in the name of Rava, it is a decree, lest he give them a roundabout way. So the word for decree is gezera, and it's really kind of a technical term. And what that means, it's a rabbinical prohibition. So the rabbis have passed a law saying he can't take it back. Why? Because he might give the public road a roundabout way, which is considered cheating the public. You know, a crooked road. Rav Mishar Shaya says where he gave them a roundabout way. So Rav Mishar Shaya is saying, in fact, he did do this, which means if you always got to look the other way, right? If he actually gave the public a straight road, then he wouldn't have to surrender the rights to the old road. That's the difference between those two things. And Rav Ashi says, anything on the side is a roundabout way, closer for this one and further for that one. In other words, the new road might be better for some people, but worse for other people. And therefore, it might be worse than the old road, and that's why he can't take it back. So therefore, all of this is a case of someone not being allowed to take the law into their own hands because the law is not on their side. But if so, why has his not reached him? In other words, if the path he tried to take from the public is not his, then why is the path he gave to the public theirs? Why not just say the switcheroo is annulled? Because he'll say, let me say, you know, okay, take yours and give me back mine. Let's switch it back. Why? Because of Rav Yehuda. Because Rav Yehuda said, a path established by the public may not be destroyed. So the answer is once the public makes a new path or takes the new path, it belongs to the public and therefore cannot be destroyed. So once he gives the path, it has to stay there. And finally, since I know you're loving this, this is proof number 7, Tashma. Come in here. An owner left a peah on one side. So peah is a corner of the field. And by Jewish law, a farmer has to leave a corner of the field for poor people to come and take. Peah, of course, is the root word of peyot, or peyus, as we say, which is the hair in the corner of your head for men, the long curls. So an owner has a designated peah on his field, but poor people came and they collected from the other corner. This and this is peah. So it's the owner of the field designates one side to count as payah. The poor come and take it from the other side. Now they are both payah. Now, if we said that one may take the law into his own hands, why should this and this be payah? Let him take a stick and sit. So by now you know the stick and sit routine. He can go to the corner that he did not designate as the payah corner, and he could beat poor people off who are coming to take it because it's really his, is what they're saying. And why can't he do this? Because it would seem to prove, again, you can't take the law into your own hands. So Rava comes along and says, what are we really talking about when the Talmud says this and this are payah, meaning this corner and that corner? It's saying that not to prove that they are both now payah corners. That's redundant. It's coming to say that exempts them from tithes. So of course the farmer has to do tithing on his land. And we have a baraita that says, as it is taught, if one declared his vineyard ownerless and then gets up early in the morning and harvests it, he is liable, and these are all agricultural things for poor people, fallen grapes, incompletely formed clusters, you know, unripe grapes or wheat, or forgotten grapes, grapes that he missed while reaping, and for payah, but it is exempt from tithes.
Hang on, before you go on, isn't payah a form of tithes?
No. Payah is an obligation to the poor.
Right, and what are, and tithes are
tithes go to the temple.
Okay.
So it's like the case of someone who declares their field ownerless and then the next morning reclaims it, kind of like the man who wants to reclaim the road.
But if he's exempt from tithes, then because if the payah is being taken from both corners, are they then saying that you're exempt from tithes if that happens to you?
The payah corners are exempt from tithes.
Oh, so you're calculating, you're subtracting that when you calculate what you owe for tithes. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Right. The thing I don't know here, frankly, is do both payah corners now count as exempt from tithes? Because it sounds to me like a tax dodge where you declare both corners and then you take one back, but now you haven't paid a tithe on. I don't know the answer to that. So this is the end of the seven proofs. All of them are rejected. You'll be happy to know. And now we move into a new Mishnah, which is similar to the old Mishnah. So again, it's a two-part Mishnah. One's jug broke in the public domain and another person slipped in the water or was hurt by the potsherds, the broken pieces of the jug. He is liable, meaning the owner of the jug. Rabbi Yehuda says, with intent, he is liable. Without intent, he is exempt.
Intent on what? I'm not sure what act is being intended there.
In other words, the intent to break the jug on the person. This is on the person, not on the owner.
Okay.
And it's really, part two is actually unclear. The commentators argue, saying if one who put the jug out intends to keep the broken pieces, then it is still his jug and he is liable for it. But if he doesn't want to keep the broken pieces, then the jug is ownerless and he is exempt. So I just told you one thing, Lawrence, and the commentators are saying the opposite of that. So I'm not quite clear on the answer here. And maybe we'll see it as we go along. Now, this is the scenario we're going to be dealing with for most of the rest of the time. Rav Yehuda said, Rav said, this was taught only when his clothes were soiled by the water, but he himself exempt, the ground injured him. So Rav Yehuda is limiting the liability in the Mishnah to that which is directly damaged by the water in the jug. So the person's clothes got dirty from the muddy water. Then the owner of the jug is liable. But if the person himself is injured by falling on the ground, then the owner of the jug is exempt. Why? because it's not the jug that hurt him, it's the ground that hurt him. And the owner of the jug is not responsible for the ground. And what this tells you, the important thing to keep in mind is that the ground is considered ownerless. Okay, so keep that in mind, and this is going to be the debate here.
Wait, but don't people own property all the time?
This is in the public domain.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Plus, you always have an option to declare an object ownerless. So if you leave a, you know, dangerous knife blade sticking out in the public domain and you say, I no longer own this knife blade, it has a different status than if it's your knife blade. And we will see a lot of that. So this is Rabbi Yehuda, who, interesting here, we don't see this very often. He used the word I. So when I stated this before Shmuel, he said to me, so Rav Yehuda was a student of Rav. And when Rav died, Rav Yehuda switched his teacher to Shmuel. Rav and Shmuel are a famous pair in the Talmud. So Rav Yehuda is often repeating Rav's rulings to Shmuel. And that's what he's doing in this case. So he told this to Shmuel, and Shmuel came up with his own ruling here. Since we derive his stone, his knife, or his load from the pit, and with regard, let's stop right there. So the liability for the damage of a stone, a knife, or a load, you know, some kind of burden, a sack, whatever it's going to be, are derived further on in the Talmud, you would not be expected to know this on a quiz, from the law of the pit. And that law says that the owner of the pit is liable for, and now that's the next line, an ox and not a person, a donkey but not vessels. So if a person is riding an ox and the ox falls into the pit, what Shmuel's ruling says is that the owner of the pit is responsible for the damage to the ox, but not to the person. And the donkey, but not vessels. Now, vessel is a general Talmudic word, and it means lots of things, vessel, utensil. In this particular case, the best thing to think of is a saddle. So the donkey is walking in the public domain, it falls into the pit. You're responsible for the donkey, the pit owner, but not for the donkey saddle that might have gotten damaged. All right. So this is Shmuel's rule. Once again, the owner of the pit is liable for the animal, but not for the person riding on it, or not for the things that the animal is carrying. And now you get to see the first of many tables tonight. So this is Shmuel's liability for the pit in easy to grasp form. Again, the ox and the donkey, yes. The person and the vessel, no. And we are going to build a lot of table tonight. Okay, so first qualification. These words refer to killing. In other words, this is only true when the person or the vessel dies. The first vessel, I'm sorry. When the person dies. But when it comes to injury, you are liable for the person being injured, but not for, again, the vessel, the saddle. So our table expands now. So we have Shmuel when there's a death and Shmuel when there's a no death. And the difference is when there is no death, then in the first case, when there is a death and the person dies, that's like manslaughter. Shmuel's not obligated in that way. But when the person gets injured, then the owner of the pit is responsible for, you know, the five things, the loss of work, the medical bills, the embarrassment, all the other things.
Why is there greater liability if there's no death?
Because the death is an accident. In the first case, and it's just something you can't help. I mean, that's the whole thing we've talked about, where you have to flee to the city of refuge. It's manslaughter. That's just the ruling of the Talmud. I can see you're not happy with that, but I don't have a better answer.
Correct.
yeah. Okay. Let's keep building. So we have Shmuel and Rav, right? They're the famous pair. So Rav says, this is true only where the owner of the pit declares it ownerless. So our table builds up again. So Rav in the ownerless case is like Shmuel in the death case. This is why you need a scorecard to go through this. And finally, Rav qualifies it. But where he did not declare them ownerless, it is his property. So therefore, he is liable for the damages, the jug. Now, we're going to go back to the jug and the person again. So, okay. Hold on 1 second. So now we throw Rav into the mix as well. So Rav has two places. One is where he's ownerless, and the other is where he is the owner of the object. And now I'm going to go back and say, remember that we're talking about the original case was a person whose jug broke in the public domain and another person slipped in the water or was hurt by the shards. So we're really only talking about this. And forget about the ox and the donkey, they go away now because that's not the case. And to further go on, we want to talk now about the difference between Shmuel and Rav. And that's that last one shrunk down with everything removed. And as you can see, they're exact opposites. Shmuel says, you're responsible for the person, but not for the vessel. Rav says the opposite. You're not responsible for the person, but you are responsible for the vessel. So again, in our case, Rav would say he is liable for the damage done to the clothes, the muddy clothes, but not to the person. Shmuel says, no, he's liable for the damage done to the person, but not for the muddy clothes. So I'm saying that's a lot of work to get here, and we'll see some more still. Now, of course, we come in with a contradiction. So now we bring on stage Rav Oshaya, who's going to use a proof text. And he is quoting, and we've seen this before, way back with Pitt, but he's quoting a proof text from the Torah in Exodus chapter 21. When a man opens a pit, or when a man digs a pit and does not cover it, and an ox and a donkey fall into it, presumably and gets killed, the owner of the pit must pay money, the price to the owner, and the dead animal shall be his. So forget the dead animal shall be his. He's responsible for the animal. Now, what's missing from this verse, anyone? People and vessels. They're not here. So this is Rav Oshaya's objection. We look at the verse in the Torah. It says an ox, but not a person. It says a donkey, but not a vessel. So the digger of the pit only has to pay restitution if what occurs is damage to the ox or the donkey. Okay. And now that gives us our chart again. So now we have another guy in here, the Torah, who agrees about ox and donkey with Shmuel and Rav in this case.
We're not sharing the chart.
We're not sharing what?
We're not sharing the chart.
You don't see it?
Is there a visual that you're supposed to show us?
I'm seeing the chart.
Okay, you get me nervous. You don't see the chart, I'm in trouble.
I see the chart.
Yeah, I see a chart.
With the red circles.
Okay. Stu, you're behind. So that's part one of Rav Hoshaya. Now comes part two. From here they said, they are the rabbis. An ox and its vessels fell in and broke, or a donkey and its vessels were torn up. And this is where you see it's really talking about the saddle. So the ox is carrying something, but it breaks. But the vessel here is the saddle, so the saddle just gets ripped up. He is liable for the animal and exempt for the vessels. So this is a baraita that talks about the liability for the pit. The sages say if an ox with its equipment fell into the pit and the ox was wounded and the equipment broke, or if the donkey was wounded and the equipment tore, then the person who dug the pit is liable to pay restitution for any injury sustained by the animal, but is exempt for paying for the damaged equipment. And we go back to our chart and fill in the bottom. So now we have the rabbis. And if you look, they're kind of all different in the circled area. And now this is part three, and this gets a little confusing. So the rabbis say, to what is this comparable? And it's the case we've had already of the stone knife and the load in the public domain, and they cause damage. But, and I stared at this for a long time because it's very confusing. They're saying it really asks the wrong question. Instead of saying to what is this comparable, it really should have said, what is comparable to this? So they're questioning the wording, right? Because they're saying stone, knife, load, et cetera, is not in the Torah, but is derived from the pit. So we can't use the pit case and then compare it to something else. We want to find something else and compare it to this. And what they will do now is compare it to a baraita, which is in green. So the baraita says, his stone, his knife, his load in the public domain, and they cause damage. Therefore, if a stone broke his jug, he is liable. Now, what Rav Hoshaya is really doing here is introducing a new baraita in green that, first of all, directly contradicts Shmuel's ruling and actually even contradicts itself. Because in the first clause, if you leave your things out in the public domain, you are exempt for damages done by vessels, two vessels. But the second part of this says he is liable. So you are not liable. You are liable for the jug. All of which leads to, I think, our final chart for the night. This is where we stand. So again, if you will notice, no, not one of these things equals another. So we have Shmuel, we have Rav, which hasn't changed. The new Baraita comes along and says something different from both of them. And the Talmud knows this, and it says, the first clause is a difficulty against Rav. Why? Rav makes a distinction between vessels that are ownerless and vessels that are not ownerless. But the Baraita we just read does not make that distinction. So the first clause, the resha, like Rishon, is a problem for Ra. And the last clause, which says that a person who left things in the public domain is liable for damages done to the jug, right? We just saw that. He is liable. Is a difficulty against Shmuel, because Shmuel holds the owner should only be liable for the person, but not for the vessel. And then the Gemara goes on in another really confusing sentence, says, but according to your reasoning, it should be difficult to you. Now, it, in this case, is the Baraita. It's telling the Talmud itself, the Talmud is telling the Talmud, the statement you just gave me is complicated. It doesn't make sense. Why? Because as I said before, the first part of the Baraita says he's exempt, and the second part of the Baraita says he is liable. So the whole Baraita doesn't make sense. So now we want to harmonize Rav and Shmuel to go along with this. So that's going to accord, that new Baraita will accord with both of them. So here's Rav. Rav resolves his reasoning. When was this stated? When he declared them ownerless. But if he did not declare them onerous, he is liable. Therefore, and this was the last line of the new Baraita, if the stone broke his jug, he is liable. So Rav is actually adding a clause to the Baraita by saying that it's really, these are owned objects, not ownerless. And that's how he gets out of this. And Shmuel resolves it to his reasoning. Now that you have said his stone, his knife, and his load are like a pit, according to Rabbi Yehuda, who obligates for damages to vessels by a pit. Therefore, if a stone broke his jug, he is liable. So what Shmuel is doing is he's attributing the last clause in the new Baraita to Rabbi Yehuda, who disagrees with the first part of the Baraita. Rabbi Yehuda says you are liable for damages done to vessels. And Shmuel goes along with that. And that's kind of the end of this discussion. It's a little complicated. Again, credit for sticking with it. And now we have a windup here where we bring in Rabbi Elazar, who is going to kind of add a new feature to this. So he says, whenever you see this was taught only, you know, it's they're trying to come in with an exemption. Only where the person stumbled over the stone and scraped against the stone. But if he stumbled on the ground and scraped against the stone, he is exempt. So what he is saying is the owner of the stone is liable only if the person stumbled on the stone and then broke the jug on the stone. That's what the scrape part means. But if he stumbled on the ground, the owner of the stone did not cause the damage, again, because the ground is ownerless, and therefore he is exempt. So we're going back to the ground thing. And in accordance with who else holds this opinion? Not Rabbi Natan. Now, once again, Rabbi Natan is going to come later in the chapter, but when he comes, Rabbi Natan is going to give you a case where, just to make it a little complicated, two people jointly cause damage and one is exempt and the other makes full payment. So here, the ground and the stone cause the damage. Rabbi Natan would hold that since the ground can't pay, the owner of the stone should be liable for the full payment. Therefore, Rabbi Elazar would not agree with Rabbi Natan, because that's his difference. So some people say, Rabbi Elazar said, don't say he stumbled on the stone and scraped on the stone, he is liable. But if he stumbled on the ground and scraped on the stone, he is exempt. That's what we just said. Rather, even if he stumbled on the ground and scraped against the stone, he is liable, according to Rabbi Natan. Why? Because he owns both. The owner of the stone is liable even if the person stumbled on the ground. And this brings Rabbi Elazar into agreement with Rabbi Natan, which is that two people cause the damage and one can't pay, the other one pays everything. And with that, we finish.